The following lecture is part of the Quid Est Homo lecture series offered by the Personalist Project, a non-profit organization in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Recordings of our lectures are available free of charge at our website. For more information or to make a donation in support of our work, please visit us at www.thepersonalistproject.org.
I hope everyone can hear me all right. I want to just begin by saying that I have known Christopher West until a couple of weeks ago only by reputation, and that reputation was that he was far and away the great sort of apostle of the theology of the body, that he had a way of making it accessible to people so that hearts were being opened all over the country, all around the world. He's given over 1,000 talks. He's spoken in many different countries. He gives lectures, he gives seminars and talks, and that, in this means has dedicated his life to making the good news about human sexuality, the truth about human sexuality, known to a truth-starved generation. Where Dr. Healy has dedicated himself in the academic world, Christopher West has dedicated himself to going, far beyond the academic world to many people who have never heard anything like this, who have never mind studied John Paul II's encyclicals or his theology of the body. And in some ways, it's one of the things that gives me a great deal of joy tonight is that the Personalist Project wants to stand sort of on the threshold between those two worlds, between the academic world and the outside the academic world, the normal world of non-intellectuals. So it gives me a great joy that we can have both Dr. Healy, who already has a gift of making the academic more accessible, and then to be followed by Christopher West, who has made the outside the academic world his particular, sort of zone of influence. And I want to say, so I knew him by this reputation, and I knew many people who had personally been deeply touched by him, and their lives had been changed by him. And I had a certain desire that I knew from Dr. Healy's course that there was so much common ground between von Hildebrand and Wojtyła, that they shared this great vision, and I had this sort of wish that we could enter into greater dialogue since we live so close to one another. But it just never came about. Then, as I said earlier, Dr. Healy offered a couple of months ago to give this talk for us. It was on our schedule, and then there sort of erupted in the Catholic blogosphere and online following Christopher West's presentation with ABC Nightline a kind of controversy, and this controversy seemed at times to get almost acrimonious, and there were camps being set up and so on. And I saw in this, here is a moment, here is an opportunity where we can begin this dialogue that I've always wanted to have. But then I had to, Jules and I had to approach Christopher West with this, and we were having to approach him at a moment where, humanly speaking, we could only imagine that this is not an easy moment for him. That he has been severely criticized, and he's been severely criticized by von Hildebrandians. And here I am, a von Hildebrandian, close friend of Alice von Hildebrand, coming to him and saying, how'd you like to come speak for us?
He's paying me $1 million.
So what I want to say is, rather than just introducing him from the point of view of his objective accomplishments in the world, I also want us to give a couple of items that I think reveal the man a little bit in my first encounter with him then personally. At this moment when, humanly speaking, you might have expected a certain defensiveness and hostility, when we met him, I found only a sort of eagerness to learn more about von Hildebrand, a sort of enthusiasm for the idea of being able to enter into this dialogue and show much more this shared vision for the beauty of human sexuality and the truth about human sexuality, and let's link arms, let's go forward, let's do this together. So I felt that from him and deeply admired it. And then the other thing, we met together with Matt Pinto, we met in a bookstore, and we're sitting there and we're talking, and as we're talking about the ideas, the intellectual things and so on, and then Christopher West says, I'm interested in that person over there. Why is that man pulling that magazine off the rack? And then he points to a woman. He said, over there. And we look, and there's a woman, bleach blonde hair, heavily made up, provocatively dressed. He said, what is happening in her heart? That's what interests me. And I thought to myself, here is a man who is still extremely in tune with the needs, the hurts, the wounds, and this desire for souls to reach out for them, even in the midst of this sort of technical and intellectual discussion that we were having. So I think those two things reveal the character of Christopher West and the beauty of his mission, and I just want to express also to him my great gratitude for his willingness to be here tonight.
Good evening. Bless you all. Thank you for being here. I'd like to begin by expressing a particular debt of gratitude as one who has devoted himself to studying the works of John Paul II and promoting the works of John Paul II. I think we who are in this field, doing this work, promoting the beautiful vision of John Paul II, we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Dietrich von Hildebrand. As my friend Matthew Pinto often likes to point out, the pioneers take the arrows, and the settlers take the land. Dietrich von Hildebrand was nothing short of a pioneer. And he took many, many arrows in his day to clear the way for someone like John Paul II to do his most important work in presenting to the world a glorious redemptive vision of human sexuality. We cannot conceive of John Paul II's vision apart from the pioneering work of Dietrich von Hildebrand. That has to be expressed and clearly understood by those who are involved in this very important work. I've been asked to unfold some of the parallels, and I was also given the freedom to demonstrate any lack of parallel or even disagreement in the thought of Dietrich von Hildebrand and John Paul II. I could take many, many different approaches in this presentation. There are so many, many parallels. The differences, the contrasts, I would say, are not even very significant. I don't even want to go there. I'd be getting into minutiae that I don't think are important right now. The parallels are worth emphasizing. So much of what Dr. Healy spoke of tonight, I said, oh, that comes from love and responsibility here, or that's where John Paul II developed it over here in the theology of body, or he said this in this encyclical. I was on the plane the other day reading his talk. He gave me an advanced copy so I could prepare. And just the electrical circuits in my brain were going haywire, making all the connections. So I could go in many, many different directions tonight. I could speak of the great personal depth of human sexuality. John Paul II says in Familiaris Consortio that human sexuality is not merely something biological. It concerns the innermost depth of the human person as such. Did he pluck that right out of Dietrich von Hildebrand? It is certainly possible. I could go in the direction of the beautiful parallels between John Paul II's vision of celibacy for the kingdom and Dietrich von Hildebrand's vision of celibacy for the kingdom. But I'm not going to go there. Where I'm going to zoom in tonight is what I consider to be the pearl of both great thinkers. And here it is. The pearl of both great thinkers, in my opinion, is this. That purity is a living possibility. It's not merely an idea to be discussed in academic journals, but it is a living possibility. There is another way to see, live, and experience our sexuality than what is presented in the dominant culture. And also what is very often presented in our upbringings. How many of you were raised in a Christian home? Can I see a show of hands? Okay. How many of you would say that in your upbringing, there is open, honest, normal, healthy conversation about God's glorious, beautiful, wonderful plan for making us male and female, and you learned growing up that the one flesh union of husband and wife is a great mystery that foreshadows the eternal ecstasy and bliss that awaits us in heaven? Please raise your hand. One person. Two. Okay, so we're about 1%. Or a little bit more. And that's the figure I get. I ask audiences this question around the world. In other words, the anecdotal evidence suggests that upwards of 98 to 99% of Christians have not heard what true Christian purity is and that it is a living possibility. Not just something to write a paper about, but something to experience. Dietrich von Hildebrand knew that this is a living possibility. John Paul II knew that this is a living possibility, and that's where I want to go. Could you turn out or pull out your handout for me? I want to put an if on this question. Is purity possible? The answer is yes, but there's an if. If we are willing to undergo a long, difficult, painful, and exhilarating journey. It is nothing other than the journey that Christ invites everyone on when he says, take up your cross and follow. The mystics speak of three different stages of this journey. It's the journey of the interior life. It's the journey of the Christian life. And the three stages they so often speak of are the purgative way, the illuminative way, and the unitive way. On the plane the other day, reading Dr. Healy's presentation, I found a deep unity with what he described, drawing from the writings of Dietrich von Hildebrand, what he called, number one, a will to purity, number two, an organic purity, and number three, the perfection of purity. There's a beautiful parallel here with the purgative way, the illuminative way, and the unitive way. For how many of you is this new language, purgative, illuminative, unitive? Okay, I'm just going to unfold it as John Paul II himself does. In one of his final works, indeed, I believe it was the final written work or published work of John Paul II before he died, a beautiful book called Memory and Identity. Look at quote A there. John Paul says, in reality, these are not three distinct ways, but rather three aspects of the same way, along which Christ calls everyone, as he once called the young man in the gospel. And I want to draw out a very important point here. It's not like in our Christian journey, we graduate from the purgative stage and enter the illuminative stage. And then we graduate from the illuminative stage and enter the unitive stage. Within each of the stages, you will taste the other elements of the three. We all start on the purgative stage of the journey. But within that purgative stage, where we are being cleansed of sinful habits and sinful ways of thinking and behaving, we are also experiencing illumination of God's plan. And we are also beginning to experience tastes of union with God. Similarly, as we progress and we are living more in the illuminative stage, it doesn't mean we still do not need to be purged. We do. And of course, we taste experiences of union with God. But it is possible, as we continue our journey, as we enter what the saints and mystics call the unitive stage of the journey, we come to a more or less constant experience of deep intimacy and union with God. A union that the mystics boldly describe using biblical imagery as nuptial union. Dr. Healy spoke very eloquently of that intimate center, that secret place within each of us that we open only to a spouse. Who's our ultimate spouse? The ultimate marriage is not the marriage of Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis, which begins the biblical story. The ultimate marriage is the marriage at the other end of the book, at the other end of the scripture, the book of Revelation. And that is the marriage of Christ and the church. The whole purpose of the first marriage from Genesis is to point us to the ultimate marriage, the union of Christ and the church. St. Paul says this very clearly in Ephesians chapter 5. For this reason, a man will leave his father and his mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. It's simply a quote from the book of Genesis. Then he says, this is a great mystery. And it refers to Christ and the church. That intimate center. Remember that quote from John Paul II. Sexuality is by no means merely biological. It concerns the innermost being of the human person, the innermost being. That innermost being is something, yes, we can enter to open to a spouse, but we must also open to God. And I would say even more, there's something that we open to God that belongs to God and God alone. I love my wife dearly, but if I seek ultimate happiness in her love for me and my love for her, I will be disappointed. There is a place within us to which sexuality only points that belongs to God and God alone. How do we get to that place where we are opening those depths to God and experiencing His living presence in our lives? There is no other journey than to take up our cross and follow through the purgative, the illuminative, and the unitive way. So let's take a look, and I will be drawing out some aspects of Dr. Healy's presentation as we go here. The purgative stage. This is the first stage of our journey towards purity. It involves a firm resolve to follow God's commandments. Dr. Healy spoke of a will, an act of the will to live a pure life. And of course, let's just say this up front. When we use purity, when we say that word purity, John Paul II makes this very clear, and I'm sure Dietrich von Hildebrand does as well. Although we often connect purity with the realm of sexuality, purity is broader than our sexuality. Purity involves uprightness and honesty and integrity in all of our actions. Tonight we have a particular focus on our sexuality, so I may share that focus, but we do need to keep in mind how broad purity is, not merely sexual purity, but purity of life in all aspects. Purity of life in all aspects begins with a firm commitment of the will to do that which is good and to reject that which is not. But because we are fallen, because we have all inherited original sin, we immediately recognize that we have disordered desires within us. We are attracted to those things that we shouldn't be attracted to. St. Paul says, I see that which I want to do. But I see also a war within me. I end up doing what I don't want to do. Who cannot relate to that? St. Paul cries out almost in anguish, who can save me from this wretched situation? And a lot of us, I think, kind of get ourselves off the hook by saying, oh yeah, I can relate to Paul there. I mean, I can't do much better than just, you know, experience the raging war within me. Well, read the next line. St. Paul says, praise be to Jesus Christ. The same man, St. Paul, who spoke very frankly about that internal war within us between good and evil, also proclaims in Ephesians that there is a power at work in each and every one of us, the power of redemption, that is capable of doing far more than we think or imagine. It's something I want to pose for our reflection tonight. Does that power, does the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, does it reach those depths of our sexuality? Or does it not? Can it transform us in the way we see and think and experience our sexuality? Or can it not? John Paul II, Dietrich von Hildebrand, both believe it does and it can. But we must stay this journey. Look at the first bullet there. In this stage, the purgative stage, we learn how to restrain ourselves from sin with the help of the grace of God, strengthening our will. And so we are strengthened to act against our disordered passions. Let me give you an example. I love beer. Good beer. And I often have a desire within me to drink more beer than is reasonable. And when I'm reaching for that 12th or 13th, when I'm reaching for that third or fourth beer, and I know maybe I've had enough, I feel a war within me. Reason can recognize the good, but within me I sense a war. I want that beer, or whatever your war might be. Maybe it's with a bag of potato chips. Maybe it's with an email you just received enticing you to look at internet pornography. We must make a firm decision of the will to act against the disorder of our passions. Everybody with me, can you think of something in your own life where that makes it real? Everybody can think of something. Certainly we can. In the language of St. Thomas Aquinas, such a person is continent, but he is not yet virtuous. Look at the distinction Thomas makes here. Quote B, continence falls short of being virtue, since virtue presupposes a right desire. And this is lacking in Christopher West when he wants to drink the fourth and fifth and sixth beer. Virtue demands that my passion itself be rightly ordered. The Catechism makes this very clear. Quote C, human virtues order our passions, and by doing so, they make possible ease, self-mastery, and joy in the three beers that I do drink. Only one who is master of himself knows how to enjoy a good beer. Only one who knows how to fast knows how to feast. There's a story that has been passed down through the ages, and you know, who knows how historically true it is, but nonetheless, there's a profound point here. The story is this, that Teresa of Avila was overcome with hunger in the middle of the night, and she went down into the kitchen and started eating some leftover partridge, one of her favorite things to eat. And she was really grooving on this partridge. And her sisters overheard the commotion in the kitchen. They came down, utterly scandalized by mother just digging into this partridge. And they said, "Mother, what are you doing?" And she looked up from her feast and she said, "Well, when I feast, I feast. Because when I fast, I fast." She's making the connection between feasting and fasting. And that's the ebb and flow of Catholic life, is it not? The Catechism says this. Why do we fast? To prepare us for the feast. So none of this self-denial, and Dr. Healy made this abundantly clear, none of the self-denial of our bodily passions come from a Manichaean or prudish fear or rejection of our body and its passions. Rather, comes from a realistic assessment of the disordering of our passions and our need to grow in self-mastery. I strongly recommend that every one of us here make a point, a very practical point, on a daily basis of asceticism. Even in small ways, if you like salt on your chicken, just deny yourself some salt. You will be amazed at the war you get in with that salt shaker. Is the salt shaker master of me, or am I master of the salt shaker? Only one who is master of the salt shaker can enjoy the salt on the chicken. This is very much a part of Catholic life. Look at quote number letter D. This is from John Paul II. Observance of the commandments, properly understood, is synonymous with the purgative way. It means conquering sin, moral evil in its various guises. And this leads to gradual inner purification. The battle lessens as we grow in self-mastery. The salt shaker no longer has a power over us. We're exercising our virtue muscles. That's an expression I love to use with my kids. Kids, we got to exercise our virtue muscles here. And hence we conclude that the purgative way leads organically into the illuminative way. This illuminative way opens up new worlds for us. Sadly, my experience is, from my own life and speaking to so many people around the country and around the world, that our Christian formation usually takes us to the purgative stage and just leaves us there. And we think that's all we can hope for in life. And we end up calling that virtue, because we certainly don't want to say to ourselves that virtue is not possible, so we call this virtue. Rather than growing towards what virtue really is, we water down what virtue is so that we can believe we are actually virtuous, when in fact we are merely continent. Grace affords much more than I think most people realize. Dietrich von Hildebrand was very clear on this. John Paul II is very clear on this. So let us enter now into the illuminative stage. Let's see what we can learn. In the illuminative stage, say that 10 times, illuminative stage. In the illuminative stage, God's light illuminates our lives. The lights come on, and we begin to see reality more and more as God made it to be. We live in darkness. Each and every one of us has a kind of spiritual amnesia as a result of the original sin. We have got a conk on the head, and we have forgotten who we really are. Creation has gone dark. We don't see. Each and every one of us, we are the blind man in the gospel who must cry out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. I want to see. I want you to ask yourself this question tonight. Do you want to see? And don't answer that question too quickly. Because when the lights come on, it rocks our world. And it is true, it's in the medical journals, that blind people, physically blind, who have been blind from birth, who have been given their sight later in life through technology and medicine, have sometimes regretted the operation. Why? Why would they regret the operation? Any thoughts?
They were comfortable with what they experienced.
They were comfortable with the world as they knew it. And although they were blind, they learned to get around. They knew where the furniture was in the house, and they could get around fairly well. We are like that. We learn to cope with mere continence. We can make our way through the world with mere continence. We know where the obstacles are and how to kind of avoid them, but we're still in the dark. Do you want to see? Now, I would assume that anyone showing up here to this kind of lecture has been on the journey long enough that you have begun to see some things. But we're all probably like that blind guy in the gospel who was healed a little bit, and things were still a little fuzzy. And he said some strange things like, yes, I can see, but people look like walking trees. I don't know what that actually means, but to me, you know, if we take that, I think it's a symbol for us or a sign for us that we're in need of being touched over and over and over again. One of the most important maxims in my life is this: beware of false summits. I must remind myself of this over and over and over again. Beware of false summits. We are climbing a mountain in the Christian life. And from our vantage point, we're getting to a certain point on the climb, and we're experiencing a new level of freedom, and we believe we're there. I got it figured out. False summit. You know what it is in mountain climbing, a false summit? You get to this point where you think you're at the top, and then you realize, oh, the summit is way over here. As John of the Cross says, there is always more. There is always more. There is always more. We never stop in our growth. There is always more. We are talking about communion with the infinite. That means there's always more. Even in heaven, there will be more and more and more of the Trinity that we experience for all eternity, because God is infinite. So as these lights come on, we come inwardly to value that which God values. And we come to desire that which God desires. Pope Benedict says in God is Love, his first encyclical, that this is the mark of true love of God. That we want what he wants. Not just intellectually, but we feel it in our hearts. We come to desire what God desires, and sin becomes repulsive to us. We don't want to commit it. because we feel more and more the very heart of the Father beating in us, the very heart of Christ beating in us. We come to enter more and more into the light of Christ. And the light of the world came to cast out that darkness. At this stage, we move from mere continence to virtue. We see that which is true, good, and beautiful, and we desire it with all our hearts. At this stage, we are experiencing more and more the freedom for which Christ has set us free. St. Paul is so clear on this. We are called to freedom. Do not take up again a yoke of slavery. In my travels, I run into all kinds of different perspectives on these things. What is appropriate, for example, for, say, a young engaged couple? They want to be chaste. They want to save themselves for marriage. What would be appropriate in terms of their affection for one another? What would be appropriate in terms of even their spending time together? And in some of the more extreme positions on these questions, which are open for conversation, I hear things like this. Well, you never better be alone together, because you know what's going to happen if you're alone together. Okay, take a good-hearted couple. If they know their weaknesses, if they know if they were alone together, they would engage in behavior that they shouldn't be engaging in, I will be the first to commend them for not being alone together. Christian, know thyself. But we must not call that virtue. Such a couple is continent, but they are not virtuous in the true sense of the word, in the Thomistic sense of the word. Think of it from this perspective. If the only thing that kept you from having sex before you got married was the fact that you didn't have the opportunity, what does that say about the desires of your heart? And then there is a real and present danger of justifying lust within the marriage. Here's the kind of visual that comes to me when I think this through. You get this good-hearted engaged couple. They've never been told about the progress of the Christian life. They've been dropped off at the curb of continence, and they think that's all they can expect. Okay, so I'll chain myself to this tree, and you chain yourself to that tree, so we can't get at one another. What then does the honeymoon become? Oh, now we are allowed to cut the chains loose. Cut. Is that an act of love? Is that an act of purity? There is no magic trick on the wedding day that suddenly makes what you do that night an act of love. If you could not be alone together the day before you got married and not sin, there's no magic trick, there's no waving of the wand at the altar that suddenly makes your sexual behavior beautiful, true, good, lovely, and pure. We must take up our cross and follow. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. This freedom is a real, living possibility if we are willing to undergo deep and painful purifications. Quote E from John Paul II. Values are lights which illuminate existence. Remember I said at this stage of the journey we come to value that which God values. Values are lights which illuminate existence. And as we work on our lives, they shine ever more brightly on the horizon. So side by side with the observance of the commandments, which has an essentially purgative meaning, we develop virtues. For example, in observing the commandment, you shall not kill, we discover the value of life, and we learn an ever deeper respect for it. In observing the commandment, you shall not commit adultery, we acquire the virtue of purity. And this means, I love this expression, this means that we come to an ever greater awareness of the gratuitous beauty of the human body, of masculinity and femininity. And this gratuitous beauty of the human body becomes a light to guide our actions. When we smell the beauty of a rose, we do not want to trample upon it. When we behold beauty, we do not want to desecrate it. Purity is the ability to see the gratuitous beauty of our sexuality, of our creation as male and female, and the call of the two to become one flesh. For stamped right in our bodies as male and female is a sign, an icon of beauty itself. Beauty with a capital B. For we are made in the image and likeness of God as male and female, which means our bodies, our sexuality. These are not mere biological realities. These are theological realities. And those who are pure of heart see this. Not only can they write about it in a doctoral dissertation, they can see it with their eyes and feel it and sense it in their heart, and they are filled with such awe, they are overcome with such beauty, that they are ready and willing to make any sacrifice to uphold that beauty, to uphold the dignity of the human being. Yes, with some remaining tension, yes, with some remaining war, we are never in this life free of the pool of concupiscence. Never. Mother Teresa could certainly still feel on her dying day, at some level, a pull. This is part of our fallen condition. But John Paul II says, in so many ways, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Do not take up again a yoke of slavery. Christ has liberated us, John Paul II says, from the domination of concupiscence. Christ has liberated us from the domination of concupiscence, John Paul II says. And this is what we come to experience more and more in the illuminative stage of the journey. Turn to the other side of your handout. Letter F. John Paul continues. So the illuminative stage in the interior life emerges gradually from the purgative stage. With the passage of time, if we persevere, very important, it's not overnight, it's not a magic trick, it's not just say this nice prayer for purity and tomorrow you'll be pure. And here we see a very important difference between Reformation theology and Catholic theology. Many of the reformers believe that the human being is utterly depraved in his fallenness. And so an image that came out of the Reformation, sometimes it's attributed to Luther, sometimes it's attributed to Calvin. I don't know the real history there. But here's the image. You are a pile of dung because of original sin. But God covers you over with a layer of white snow so that he doesn't have to smell your dung. The Catholic vision of sanctification and redemption, you might say, is the converse. We are white snow because that's the way God made us. But through sin, we've been covered with a layer of dung. And in the redemption, the dung is removed. And as we journey through the purgative and into the illuminative and ultimately into the unitive stage of the journey, each of these are stages we can experience here in this life. The dung is removed so that the beautiful purity of our white snow within can shine forth. So one of John Paul II's favorite expressions is, become what you are. Become what you are. Who we really are, the deepest truth of our humanity, lies in the creation before sin distorted it. And as the Catechism says, Christ came into the world to restore creation to the purity of its origins. Dietrich von Hildebrand knew this very well, as did John Paul II. But on our part, it demands perseverance in following Christ our teacher, And if we persevere, we feel less and less burdened by the struggle against sin. And we enjoy more and more the divine light which pervades all of creation. This is most important, John Paul says, because it allows us to escape from a situation of constant inner exposure to the risk of sin. And here he adds the necessary element of realism and balance. Even though on this earth, the risk always remains present to some degree of falling into sin. Beware of the false summit. Beware of overconfidence in yourself. But have total confidence that Christ is at work and he will bring to completion the work he has begun within you. So as we enter into this freedom, as we are liberated from this constant inner exposure to the risk of sin, we come to move with ever greater freedom within the whole created world. This same freedom and simplicity characterizes our relations with other human beings, except those of the opposite sex. Oh wait, I'm sorry, what does yours say? Including those of the opposite sex. And my little joke there is meant to point something out. John Paul II says we must beware of the interpretation of suspicion. He speaks of the masters of suspicion. A master of suspicion is someone who is so bound by lust within himself or herself that that person projects that onto everyone else and does not really believe that Christ's redemption was effective. Now, certainly, you must know where you are on the journey. There are those who are so bound by alcohol that they should not go to a party where others are drinking. There are those who are so bound by alcohol that they should not even walk down a street where there's a bar. And those who understand their own interior state and their weakness, who avoid those occasions, God bless them. That's necessary for them. They're on the purgative stage of the journey. And that purgative stage might be a really long time in that person's life. But that person should not project his own bondage onto everyone else. And when those who are bound by lust or whatever other vice are projecting that onto others, then others' freedom and purity becomes to them vice. In this stage, interior light illumines our actions and shows us all the good in the created world as coming from the hand of God. Where do we discover all the good that God has created? Only in a church? Where is the good that God has created? Everywhere. God looked at everything he made and said, "Behold, it is very good." And in the illuminative stage of the journey, we are coming more and more to see that good everywhere we look. Everywhere we look. Everywhere we look. We're all tarnished gold. Each and every one of us. We are tarnished gold. And for those with the eyes to see, we can look at a person like Hugh Hefner and see gold. And if others want to project their own impurity on those who see the gold, but this isn't the end of the journey. There's more. There's always more. If the purgative and the illuminative stages represent a kind of betrothal of our lives to God, remember the end game here is the mystical marriage. The end game here is the marriage of Christ and the church. That's where we're all headed. That's the imagery Scripture uses to give us a little glimmer into what awaits us in eternity. And so we could say, using this spousal image from the Scriptures, that in the purgative and illuminative stages, we experience a kind of betrothal of our lives to God, the beginning and maturing of a divine love affair. But in this final stage, we experience the consummation of the marriage. And this is the fullest expression of union with God possible in this life. And it is the fullest expression of purity possible in this life. I want to return to Dr. Healy's comments here, just so you can see the parallels that I'm unfolding. He spoke in the first stage of a will to purity. He says this would always involve a deep-rooted will to purity, firmly so chosen as a positive virtue. Yet this commitment, and here we see maybe a discrepancy in some of the language. He's using the word virtue here. I was using the word continence. Maybe we can hammer this out in the Q&A. Yet this commitment of the will does not by itself, very important, we're on the purgative stage of the journey, this commitment by itself does not emancipate the heart from being captured in the main still by the charm of sexuality as an isolated or selfish end in itself. Stage two, in his presentation, the next stage of purity, which we're calling the illuminative stage, would be when the will to purity has become organic enough in one's thoughts, desires, and emotions that one has, for the most part, won the battle and is only open now to isolated temptations towards a disintegrated view of sexuality. The third stage of the journey, in the thought of Dietrich von Hildebrand, as eloquently unfolded for us by Dr. Michael Healy, is the perfection of purity. So let's take a look at how John Paul II unfolds this. H. The purgative way and the illuminative way form the organic introduction to what is known as the unitive way. This is the final stage of the interior journey, when the soul experiences a special union with God. This union is realized in contemplation of the divine being, and in the experience of love, which flows from that contemplation with ever-growing intensity. Let me pause there for a moment and say something about the difference or the distinction between meditation and contemplation. Meditation involves an engagement of the mind in an active kind of way with, say, a passage of scripture or a poem or some beautiful theological writing. And we gain much, much, much from that practice, from meditation. Contemplation is a little bit different. Contemplation is an open receptivity to a divine inspiration, if you will. And one of the best images I've ever heard of what contemplation involves was a surfing analogy. Our role in contemplation is to get on the surfboard and paddle out into the waves. But we have no control over when the wave comes. That's the divine gift. But when that wave comes, we ride it the whole way into shore. In our prayer life, we must learn to tune our minds to a very astute level of meditation. But even more so, we must learn to open our hearts to this divine gift, which traditionally is called contemplation. In this way, John Paul says, we somehow anticipate what is destined to be ours in eternity, beyond death and the grave. Christ, supreme teacher of the spiritual life, together with all those who have been formed in his school, teaches that even in this life, we can enter onto the path of union with God. A union that the mystics call nuptial union. Look right above there at letter G. This is from John of the Cross. The spiritual marriage is incomparably greater than the spiritual betrothal. In other words, this unitive stage of the journey is incomparably greater than what we experience in the purgative and illuminative stages of the journey. And remember, folks, this is supposed to be normal Christian life. Because we are all called to be saints. In a sense, we're all called to be mystics. Not that we're all supposed to have these, you know, levitations up into the rafters when we receive Christ in the Eucharist, like some of the mystics did. But we're called to what you might say is an everyday mysticism. An everyday entering into the mystery, which is God's love for us and our generous, open response to it. This is where we open something to God that's even deeper than what we could ever open to a spouse. But John on the cross here compares this opening to God to that which spouses experience. In the spiritual marriage, we experience a total transformation in the beloved of course being God, because we surrender ourselves entirely to God, and God surrenders himself entirely to us in a consummation of the union of love. In this way, the soul becomes divine, John on the cross says. God through participation, insofar as is possible in this life. Just as in the consummation of carnal marriage there are two in one flesh, so also when the spiritual marriage between God and the soul is consummated, there are two natures in one spirit and love. Such a person is not concerned with how many beers should I have. Such a person rejoices in the right amount of beer without a second thought. Such a person is not concerned, let's say a married couple reaches this level. A married couple is not concerned with, oh, are we allowed to do this in the marriage bed? I don't, let's look this up. They don't want to do anything. They're so sensitive in their hearts to what would violate ever the dignity of the act and the dignity of the person. That they smell any even slight movement in that direction 100 miles away. It's not about following rules anymore. It's about opening ever more deeply to the great mystery of divine love. And it involves a freedom from the law that St. Paul spoke of. Not a freedom to break the law, but a freedom to fulfill the law, because we do not desire to break it. Letter I, to the degree that we enter this unitive way, we can find God in everything. We can commune with him in and through all things. All things. Created things cease to be a danger for us as they once were, particularly while we were still at the purgative stage of our journey. Creation, and other people in particular, not only regain their true light given to them by God the Creator, but so to speak, creation itself and other people in particular lead us to God himself in the way that he willed to reveal himself to us as Father, Redeemer, and Spouse. I close with a story. I just came back yesterday from 5 days in Hawaii. I was giving some lectures there, and I met the most beautiful man. He's a chief of a Hawaiian tribe, and he's a tour guide. He brings people through this tropical rainforest, and he points out all the fruits and what they mean, and I saw his beauty. This guy was rough around the edges, all right? My mother would have been utterly scandalized by some of his sexual innuendo, which I came to learn was a rich, I don't mean rich in the sense of valuable, but a deep part of their culture. There was a real clash when the Christian missionaries showed up in Hawaii because of this just common practice in their language of a sexual innuendo. And yeah, some of it's like, whoa, that was a little jarring. But still, remember tarnished gold. Tarnished gold. We are not utterly depraved. That means even when things get twisted up, when we have the eyes to see through the tarnish, we see the gold. And even though I'm one, I would consider myself rather comfortable with sexual matters. I found myself a little jarred. Nonetheless, I saw this man. I saw him. I saw his beauty. And for him, cracking open a coconut is a mystical experience. I'm not kidding. The way he cracked open this coconut, it's an image for us all. It's an image for us all. We want an image of the journey that we must go on. Here it is. Coconut, all right? We have this sheath that covers the coconut, right? And it has to be thrust through with this sharp spear. And you have to know exactly where to place the spear. Because if you place the spear in the wrong spot, you're going to ruin the meat within. You're going to ruin the coconut. What we call a coconut is really the core of a coconut, which is the big, you know what I'm talking about? So with great skill, with great precision, this guy's got tattoos all over him, all right? And if you saw him on the street, you'd be like walking, whoa, whoa. This man was beautiful. And he cracks open this coconut, he pierces the coconut with this spear, and he tears off very delicately, but also with authority, whoosh, he rips off the sheath to get to the core. We have to allow the Lord to do this to us. We have to allow that piercing. And the Lord is a meticulous and precise surgeon. He knows just how to do it with love and skill, just as this mystical Hawaiian chief did. Tore off the husk, and now we have the core. The core's got to be cracked open to get to the juice and the meat and then the milk and then the oil. Rock. With great skill. I mean, I felt like I was watching Beethoven perform. That's the kind of skill this guy had with this rock and this coconut. He whacks this coconut. You got to hit it right on the precise spot, because if you hit it on the wrong spot, you're going to crack it, you're going to ruin the fruit. You got to get it right on the right seam. Perfect halves of the coconut. And, you know, about 10 people on the tour, he says, who wants to drink the juice of these coconuts? And I said, I do. I was taken into this mystical experience with the coconuts. I'm telling you, it was for real. And I, with great delight, drank the juice of the coconuts. And he says, that's just the juice. We're not finished yet. And he started shaving the meat off this coconut. And this beautiful, beautiful meat was coming off this stick that he was just rubbing. And yeah, there's all kinds of sexual innuendo going on. I saw the beauty. I saw the beauty. To the pure, all things are pure. I saw the beauty, and I ate that coconut meat with such delight. It was a mystical experience for me. He says, but we're not finished yet. He says, what you call coconut milk in the States is actually the juice, which you already drank. Let me show you the milk. And he wrapped up this huge pile of shredded coconut in the sheath, this kind of like hairy part of the sheath. And he went, whoosh, twisted it. And all this glorious milk just exploded from his hands. This white, creamy substance. And he says, we put this in a bowl, and when we set it out in the sun for 3 days, and it turns into coconut oil. If we want to be pure of heart, we must allow the piercing. We must allow the shredding. We must allow the cracking. We must drink the juices along the way. Part of the journey. It's not just all bitter suffering. The Lord gives us these oases along the way where we can drink the juices of the coconut. But then we have to continue the journey, go through the shredding. And then the milk comes forth. And then as we bake in the sun, the heat of the Father's love, in the unitive stage of the journey, we become oil. And then that oil can be spread out to all God's children. We long for that oil. We must commit ourselves to that journey. That's where purity lies. That's where purity lies. Is purity possible? Yes. Not on our own strength. Not on our own strength. But through the power of the death and resurrection Jesus Christ and the oil of his sacraments. Take that image of the coconut and apply it to Christ himself, and you will see how he allowed the piercing. You will see how he allowed the flow from the depths of his heart to come out as blood, as water, as oil, to anoint us to heal us so that we might become the men and women God created us to be. May God be praised now and ever and forever. Amen. Thank you very much.